Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Humanity has dealt with many such epidemics before, and we are probably in a better situation than ever before in history.
Philosopher and best-selling author Yuval Noah Harari on how globalization is the best weapon against the coronavirus. Then a break from the virus as we go on an odyssey through ancient Greek myths and modern democracy with the inimitable wit and actor Stephen Fry. Plus,
the city was 56% black, as I had said, in 1898. Today, it's 18%. So they just turned a black majority city overnight into this white supremacist citadel.
A murderous coup that changed everything. Author David Zucchino talks to our Walter Isaacson about an overlooked bloody conflict and the rise of white supremacy in Wilmington, North Carolina. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The week began with Italy locking down the epicenter of its coronavirus outbreak and 16 million people, and it was the West's most dramatic move yet. But by the end of this week, all of Italy, 60 million people, are under quarantine, and President Trump had banned all travel from Europe into the United States for the next 30 days, starting at midnight Friday.
This is the most aggressive and comprehensive effort to confront a foreign virus in modern history. To keep new cases from entering our shores, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days.
Trillions of dollars have been wiped off the world's stock markets. Culture, sports, schools, hospitals are all under siege as social distancing becomes the rule. In crises like these, people all over always look to their leaders for, well, leadership. But my next guest argues that instead there have been no clear answers and a rapid loss of trust and confidence between people and their governments, making this crisis far worse. Best-selling author and philosopher Yuval Noah Harari joined me to talk about it. He wrote blockbuster books such as Sapiens about human nature, and he's a history professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Yuval Noah Harari, welcome back to our program.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, these are extraordinary days. I don't know, you have written obviously a lot about history, a lot about what makes us human. Have you seen in modern times, in our technological, economic, globalized society, a crisis quite like this one?
Like this one, not really. I mean, we haven't seen an epidemic, a global epidemic like this for at least 100 years. And really, nobody has a living experience of what's going, of what we are seeing now, which is part of what makes it so frightening and so alarming. But when you look at the broader perspective of history, then yes, humanity has dealt with many such epidemics before, and we are probably in a better situation than ever before in history to deal with such an outbreak.
Because of?
Because of modern medicine. You know, when the Black Death erupted in the 14th century, so it swept from China to Britain in about 10 years, killing between a quarter and half of the entire population of Asia and Europe, and nobody had any idea what is happening, what is the cause of the disease, and what can be done about it. Today, with the coronavirus epidemic, it took just 2 weeks for scientists and doctors not just to identify the virus behind the outbreak, but also to sequence its entire genome and to develop tests that at least tell us who has the virus and who hasn't. So there is still a way until we overcome this, but we are, in a better position than in any previous time in history.
But let's not forget that this swept from China to Britain to the United States within a much, much shorter period of just a few months. What, as an ordinary citizen now, frightens you most, or do you wish most could happen to stop the panic at least? Mm.
I think the worst thing is the disunity we see in the world, the lack of cooperation, coordination between different countries, and the lack of trust, both between countries and also between the population and the government. This is basically the payday for what we've been seeing in the last few years with the epidemic of fake news and with the deterioration of international relations. If you compare this, for example, to the 2008 financial crisis, which is, of course, a crisis of a different kind, but there are similarities, in 2008, you had responsible adults in the world which took a leadership position, rallied the world behind them, and prevented the worst outcomes. But over the last 4 years, basically, we've seen a rapid deterioration of trust in the international system. The country which was the leader previously, both in the 2008 financial crisis and also in the last big epidemic, the Ebola epidemic in 2014, and that country is the United States, now it's not taking any kind of leadership position. Actually, since 2016, the current administration has made it very clear that the U.S. has resigned its role as world leader. It made it very clear that the U.S. has no longer any friends in the world. It has only interests. And even if now the U.S., which is not doing so far, but even if it will try to assume a leadership position, nobody would really follow a leader whose motto is me first. So what really frightens me is the lack of leadership and cooperation. And what people should realize is that the spread of the epidemic in any one country threatens the entire world because of the danger that if we don't contain this in time, the virus will evolve. That's maybe one of the worst problems with this kind of epidemic is actually a rapid evolution of the virus. We saw it before with the 2014 Ebola epidemic. It actually started, the real epidemic started with one genetic mutation in one virus in one person in West Africa, which turned Ebola from a relatively rare disease into a raging epidemic, because this single mutation increased the contagiousness of the virus 4 times. Now, this could be happening right now, somewhere in Iran or in Italy or anywhere else. And wherever it happens, it endangers the entire world. So humanity needs to close ranks against the viruses.
You say close ranks, and that seems to be contrary to what, let's say, the populists and the nationalists have said, as you say, since 2016, whether it's in the United States, here in the UK, and elsewhere around the world, that globalization is just bad and we need to always close ranks so that we don't get anything bad from across borders. But you're saying now that has proved to be a bankrupt theory when dealing with this kind of crisis.
Yeah, because you can't deal with the virus really. I mean, you can't prevent epidemics through isolation. You can only prevent them with information. If you really want to isolate yourself to the degree that you are not exposed to outside epidemics, going back even to the Middle Ages is not enough. Because we had these kinds of epidemics even in the Middle Ages. If you really want to isolate yourself as a strategy against epidemics, you need to go back all the way to the Stone Age. And nobody can do that. The real border you need to protect very carefully is not between countries, but the border between the human world and the virus sphere. Humans are surrounded by an enormous variety of viruses in all kinds of animals and places. And if a virus crosses this border anywhere in the world, it endangers the entire human species. This is the border we should really be thinking about. If a virus originating, for example, in a bat manages to cross the border into the human species anywhere in the world, that virus then adapts to the human body, and then it's a danger to everybody all over the world. Now, it's an illusion to think that in the long term, you can protect yourself against that virus by simply closing the borders of your country. The more effective policy is to police the border between humankind and the virus world.
How do you do that?
If by supporting health systems all over the world, by realizing that something that is happening now in West Africa or in Iran or in China, it's not just a threat to the Iranians or the Chinese, it's also a threat to the Israelis. So we need more organizations like the World Health Organization and more international solidarity to help the country which is currently most affected deal with this crisis, whether it is by sending them equipment and personnel, and more than anything else, good information, good scientific information, or it is by economic support. A country where an outbreak begins, if it thinks it's on its own, it will hesitate to take drastic quarantine measures because it says, well, if we lock down the entire country or entire cities, we will collapse economically and nobody will come to help us. So let's wait and see whether it really is such a big danger. And then it's too late. Now, if a country like, I don't know, like Italy would know that if it locks itself down, it will receive help from other countries, it will be willing to take this drastic measure sooner. And this will be a benefit for the whole of humanity. Again, every euro that Germany or France spends in supporting Italy in such a situation would save them 100 euros later on, not having to deal with the epidemic in their own cities.
Now that this whole virus is out of the box and there's been, you know, one could say a slow response around the world to trying to police that border between the virus and human beings, Italy has taken a drastic measure. I mean, the whole country's in lockdown.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
I would say that this is a test, especially for the European Union, which has lost a lot of support over the last few years. And this is the chance for the European Union to really prove its worth. This is the time for the other members of the Union to come to Italy's support. If they do that, they will not only protect their own citizens, but they will show the value of such a system like the European Union. If they don't do that, the virus could destroy the Union and not just individual human lives.
I want to ask you about the social impact. Does something like this, where people are forced to self-isolate with very little information, with very little testing, with very little belief in what they're being told, how do you see this affecting society?
Well, the immediate issue is the issue of trust, whether people trust their governments and whether people trust what they hear in the media. Because to have effective quarantine, you need the cooperation of the population. And that's a very problematic issue, because this kind of trust has been eroded over the last few years. The other big issue, more long-term, is about surveillance. One of the dangers in the current epidemic is that it will justify extreme measures of surveillance, especially biometric surveillance, which will be, again, justified as a means to deal with this emergency. But even after the emergency will be over, it will remain. We are talking about a system of monitoring an entire population all the time for biometric signals, allegedly in order to protect people from future epidemics. But this can also form the basis of an extreme totalitarian regime. We are facing a huge issue of surveillance and privacy in our age. And I think that we'll see a big battle between privacy and health. And health is likely to win. That people will have no privacy at all in the name of protecting them from the spread of such epidemics. Now, the thing is that the technology can be very effective. We now have the technology to monitor entire population and discover, for example, the outbreak of a new disease when it's only just beginning and it's very easy to contain it, and to follow all the infected people and know exactly where they are and what they do. But this kind of surveillance system can then be used to monitor many other things, what people think, what people feel. And if we aren't careful, this epidemic can give justification for the accelerating development of totalitarian regimes.
That's a pretty dramatic thought to try to digest. Humans are not meant to be self-isolating people or self-isolating species. Mm-hmm. And there are already anecdotal reports from Italy and elsewhere, you know, elderly women who like to go to a cafe to chat, to have their regular contact, are being sort of disallowed. There's reports of loneliness and shut-in syndrome and depression. That's also a big worry for society.
Humans are especially vulnerable to epidemics because we are a social animal, and this is how epidemics spread. The thing about the viruses is that they often exploit the best parts of human nature against us. They exploit the fact not only that we like to socialize, but also that we help each other. When somebody is sick, the obvious, natural thing to do, especially if this somebody is a friend or a family member, is to come to them, to give them support, to take care of them, to give them emotional support, to touch them, to hug them. And this is exactly how the virus spreads. So the virus really makes use of the best parts of human nature against us. And again, there are two ways of how to deal with that. One way is to give information to people. And if people trust the information they receive, they can change their behavior at least until the epidemic is over. The other way is the totalitarian way. To have, again, it couldn't be done in the Middle Ages, but it can be done today, just to survey everybody. So it's first of all to identify the initial signals of your becoming sick. Like we now have the technology to know if your even without putting something inside your body, just from a distance, to know if your body temperature is higher. And we can know all the people that you have met today. And we know who, for example, broke the government instructions not to hug you or not to kiss you. So if people don't believe the information they receive and they don't do it out of trust, they can be compelled to do it by an omnipresent regime of surveillance. Mm-hmm. This is the dangerous path. I hope we don't go in that direction.
Yuval Noah Harari, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we look for a little relief as we go back to a time way before coronavirus, to ancient Greece. And we do so with author, actor, and welcome wit, Stephen Fry. His latest work, Heroes, recalls Greek myths and their relevance to our modern world. A Renaissance man, Fry is an iconic fixture in British culture, known for his humor, as well as his work exposing the brutal realities of mental health. He's a compelling conversationalist as well, as I found when he joined me here in the studio. Stephen Fry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Christiane.
Your book is about ancient Greece and the myths, but I just want to know, what is it about the Greek myths, ancient Greece and ancient civilization that attracts you?
Well, I think it's a number of things. One is simply, as narratives, as stories, I think they're just unsurpassable in their juice, mm-hmm. and their wit, and their marvelous depth and ambiguity. No character is all good or all bad. In that sense, they're what we think of as modern. But also, I'm fascinated by the way the world is going now, particularly the tsunami of technologies that is approaching us, not just biohacking, biotech, gene editing, you know, genomics generally, nanotechnology, quantum computing, AI, machine learning, and, of course, all the various possibilities of changing our bodies and robotics and so on. All these coming together, they're coalescing into one huge existential change for the world, and people talk about elements of it. And it's strangely enough in myth that you can see these things. The Greeks talked about the time when the gods punished us for having fire, for having self-consciousness, and Prometheus, our champion, who stole fire from heaven and gave it to us, was tortured on the Caucasus Mountains, and the gods, Zeus, you know, was afraid that mankind would have their own spark, their own divine fire, as well as the fire that melts and smelts and roasts and toasts. And that seems a long way away. But of course, in the 18th century, it was crucial to an understanding of releasing ourselves from the shackles of medieval ecclesiasticism. And now we're in the same position that Zeus was in. Do we give fire to our entities, our robotic AI entities, in 20 or 30 years' time, when they approach a level of intelligence? Do we give them self-consciousness in the way that... And if we do, will they no longer need us in the way we no longer needed the gods?
There's the book in front of you, Heroes. Mm. Do you have a passage that you can read for us? You mentioned Zeus, but
This is the later period of the heroes.
Yep.
And one of the most famous heroes was Oedipus. He was very appealing to characters like Nietzsche because he represented what the Athenians thought were the greatest virtues. He was intelligent, he was witty, he could solve puzzles. And he, of course, famously had the greatest puzzle of all to solve, which is why the city of Thebes had been visited and punished by the gods. And there was an uncleanliness that had happened. And he traces it to its source and discovers, of course, that it's himself, the fact that he has unwittingly married his mother and killed his father.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what we all know about Oedipus.
Yeah,
complex.
But on his way to Thebes, he can't get past the Sphinx, who is this half-lion creature, and she challenges everyone with a riddle, and if they don't answer it, they're killed. And here Oedipus shows something of why he is Oedipus, if you like. Tell me this, traveller, she says to him. What walks on 4 feet in the morning, 2 feet at noon, and 3 in the evening? 4 feet in the morning, 2 at noon, 3 in the evening... Just give me the answer to that, purred the Sphinx, and you may freely pass. Oedipus sucked in through his teeth. Man, oh man, he said, shaking his head, that's a teaser and no mistake. Ha! You can't solve it then. But I did, said Oedipus, raising his eyebrows in surprise. Didn't you hear me? The Sphinx stared. What do you mean? I just told you. Man, oh man, I said, and man is the answer. When man is born in the morning of his existence, he crawls on all fours. In his prime, the noontime of his day, he goes upright on 2 legs. But in the evening of his life, he has a third, a stick to help him on his way. But how? It's called intelligence. Now let me go on my way.
That's great.
But I sort of put it in that way. It is a famous subject. Painters love to do it, you know, Oedipus and the Sphinx. But to show his self-confidence, his over-self-confidence. Of course, he has the great tragic flaw of hubris. He believes he can solve any problem and his action in solving that problem. But what was interesting to Nietzsche about that whole subject and about the way Sophocles attacked it in his play, Oedipus Tyrannos, Oedipus the King, is that he saw the Greeks as wrestling with the two sides of human existence, the Apollonian, as he called it. Apollo was the god of harmony and reason, music, and a kind of golden light and mathematics, and Dionysus, god of frenzy and appetite and addiction and wildness and submission to the baser instincts of the self. And the Greeks seem to understand we are both those things. You can't just be Apollonian and you can't just be Dionysian. And Oedipus has this deep, dark, intense secret of his humanity, his drive, his impulse, his filth inside, but covers it with this idea, I can solve problems, I'm the new modern kind of leader. And That's as true today as it ever was. We're brought down by our instincts.
So you've also got a podcast, right, called
Yes.
The Seven Deadly Sins. Mm. Tell me about that. What's that all about?
Well, I felt...
And remind us, just in case we've all forgotten what the seven deadly ones are.
They're pride, avarice, lust, envy, gluttony, wrath and sloth. Or if you call wrath anger, you can remember them as pale gas. It's the easiest mnemonic I know. I felt that we're doing a lot of looking out and finger-pointing at what's wrong with the world outside, about how those people are letting us down and those people are the fault, their weakness, their cruelty, their bullying, their inadequacy, their rapacity. And very little looking in and saying, well, actually, the fault of the world is me. I am the one who has these slimy thoughts, these, you know. And I think... Whatever your outlook, whether religious, non-religious, and whatever sort of philosophy you ascribe to or subscribe to, most of us, when we're lying in bed at night, wish we were better. We feel we'd be happier if we were better. Not happier if we were richer necessarily, but if we were just kinder and people liked us more and we were prouder of ourselves in the best meaning of pride. And that deontic sense is very strong in all of us, I think. And I wanted to explore it and to see whether it still held up and whether those sins held up.
And avarice, you mentioned. I mean, greed.
Greed is good was the
famous.
Exactly.
But there's a new film out, and I just interviewed Steve Coogan and the director, Michael Winterbottom. And you and a number of other celebrities are in that film, which is loosely about a retail billionaire here in Great Britain who went bust but really exploited his workers and the manufacturers of cheap fast fashion in Asia.
Yeah.
But you play yourself, so does Chris Martin of Coldplay, James Blunt, I think.
Yeah, Norman Cook.
Yes. Why did you decide to do it?
I thought it was an amusing irony that I was playing myself as somebody who greedily accepted money
and
free flights to go to a billionaire's party, when in fact all I was doing was accepting the lowest possible income you can get, which is a Michael Winterbottom film.
But it is a little bit, you know, this idea of greed. It's also a sort of a morality play for today, because it informs so much, particularly the younger generation's view of politics, inequality.
Absolutely.
You know, the
And again, without being sanctimonious or pious, which neither of which are attractive qualities, I think. But in the early days of the internet, I used to go to a lot of meetings for startup companies and things, and I always used to see instantly the greediest person in the room. There are some people who go into these things in order to have an IPO, in order to sell to Google or one of the big entities in Silicon Valley, in order to have power and money, and not in order to change the world. I know that sounds ridiculously naive, but there is, in the early days of that technology, there was something so exciting about it. And I, you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for. Do you remember that phrase that was used in the early days of the dot-com explosion was move quickly and break things?
Yes.
Which is what they used to say at Facebook and at Google. And the other word, disruption.
Yes.
No one said to them, hang on, haven't you ever noticed that in life, moving slowly and not breaking things is a really good way to be? And that disrupt, you know, from the Latin rumpere, isn't it? It's a break.
And it's become a political mantra now, disruption.
And
President Trump.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And going around breaking things doesn't strike me as being that good. And the irony politically is extraordinary, because the Conservative Party that I grew up with, literally, and my parents, you know, conservative country fates and so on, in the old school way, was precisely against people breaking things. It was conserving things. It was the way things are, maybe not quite right, but will slowly evolve. And I was impatient with it, but I could sort of respect that sort of conservatism. It valued institutions. It valued things that were vindicated by history and had a patina of something that were organically made. They weren't planned in a sort of socialistic, Stalinistic way, like new towns.
Yeah.
They had grown up and they were sort of human-shaped, you know. That was the conservative approach, not to tear things down out of some attempt to build a new country, a new... And now that's completely reversed. Yeah. It is now the right wing that does the tearing down. The left wing seems sort of slightly hopelessly old-fashioned and wants to retain some things and destroy others. And I mean, it's not the only approach that you should have, is which side wants to tear things down. But it is, and it's worth observing.
It is. It's really interesting. Again, it's so relevant. Look, I mean, many people, I just want to put up this lovely old picture from 1983, where you are pictured at Cambridge with Emma Thompson, Hugh Laurie and others. Mm. And this was sort of, I guess, your the petri dish that was responsible for your growth.
It mutated the virus.
Well, let's not go all coronavirus. Yeah. But I want to get just a little bit serious, if I can make a hard turn, because then, you know, many years later, in 2006, you made a documentary. You made a documentary called The Secret Life of the Manic Depressive. Mm. You came out about your own mental health issues. You made a campaign, which we've got the picture of. And you've been the president of Mind since 2011. Mm. You've used it also in your podcast. You talk about it a lot. Mm. Just how, for those who are suffering, and there's so many people suffering out there, just what can you tell them about what you went through, about what there is there for them, about how mental health, you know, is being treated, should be treated now?
Well, I'm hoping people watching feel less alone than they might have done 10, 15, 20 years ago, when it really wasn't a subject that people discussed a great deal. Their inner moods, their personality changes, their anxieties and dreads and so on were things you tended to keep quiet about. And some people may feel that it's all being talked about too much now. But I would say this. One of the problems of not being diagnosed and not realizing that you have, a mood disorder like bipolar disorder, which is what afflicts me, is that you will do anything to change this pain, this mood, the mood that is either that you can't rest, you can't stop your mind from racing and racing and racing and racing, and you can't sleep, and you go a little bit manic, or you're so dark and depressed that you can barely move. And the things you naturally reach out to are drugs and alcohol, because they can do that. They can alter your mood. Cocaine can cheer you up if you're down, and alcohol can sort of tamp things down if you're too high. But they are obviously a disaster to become, you know, if they become something you depend upon. And people naturally look on you as just someone as a bit of a loser who's just, you know, not capable of staying sober and is a wastrel. And you look on yourself as that, you know. And then when you try and stop taking the drugs or the alcohol, you're left with the hole in the middle that you were trying to fill with those ridiculous things. And that's why it's very important, I think, to try and get some form of diagnosis, to be shown that this is a common thing. Moods. And I've described them before as being like the weather, you know. When it's raining, it really is raining. It's no good pretending to yourself it's not raining, because you'll get wet. It is, and it's windy, and you'll get blown around. But it's also important to remember that it's not your fault it's raining. You didn't cause the rain. That's a mad reach of solipsism to suggest that you... No one would do that. Oh, it's raining, it's all my fault. And because it's raining, nor does it mean it's going to rain for the rest of your life. The sun will come out. You don't know when. It's been beyond your control. It may be tomorrow. It may not be for a whole week. You may have to, you know, knuckle and hunker down for a week. But that's how it is with a mood disorder. It's so easy to think it's your fault. It's so easy to think that it's permanent. And it's so easy to think that... that it will... you know, there's nothing you can do about it. The answer is you have to find ways of coping.
And you can, and there is help if you seek it.
Yeah, and of course, it's like anything. Some people have it so seriously that they hurt each other terribly. And I had a couple of suicide attempts, and that was really, really grim. And it's like a lot of pain, like a lot of misery, it's quite hard to bring it back into your head. You can't make yourself unhappy just by remembering your unhappiness. You can think, I was unhappy. Why was I so unhappy? I wanted to do that. I don't understand that in myself. And that's a blessed thing. I think it's like you can't recall the pain of a broken arm. Suddenly you're screaming with pain again, fortunately. But it's something you have to remember to live with.
And I think when people like you, you know, tell these stories, it's really doubly and triply valuable, because people who know you can see, well, actually, you know, okay, maybe I'm not a superstar, but at least I can also be functional, and it gives them a lot of hope.
Yes, because the two important things to say, one is that it can be incredibly serious, and you mustn't underestimate the morbidity, as a doctor would say, the threat to health and life that it presents. But at the same time, there are remarkable people in the past and present living extraordinary, creative, fulfilled and happy lives with it. So the two have to be accepted.
Can I ask you a final question? And it's kind of funny. Everybody here in Great Britain will know you as the audiobook voice of the Harry Potter series, right? But you have a funny story about a line that you just couldn't get right and that J.K. Rowling was not sympathetic.
She was. There was a phrase in it, and it's just one of those weird things. It's not a difficult phrase. Three words. Harry pocketed it. Still can't say Harry pocketed it. I keep putting
Harry
in...
Harry pocketed it.
You can do it. You see, for some reason, I keep wanting to put in extra syllables. Harry pocketed it. I kept saying it and trying it, and the engineer was laughing, and I was laughing. I said, look, well, let's park it. And Joe wasn't in that particular recording session, so I called her at lunch, and because the books were unabridged, she was very determined that they shouldn't be in any way condensed or cut, because she imagined children would follow them with their fingers while listening to the record, you know, and that was a good thing. And so I called her to say, look, for some reason, Joe, I can't say Harry pocketed it. Do you mind if I say Harry put it in his pocket, which I can say? And she said, no. So eventually I managed to get it, but there were... five more Harry Potter books, and each one contains the phrase "Harry pocketed it."
she got you
bombs for
she
me.
She did. Can you actually say it right?
I'm Harry pocketed it.
Well done.
But if I try and say it at proper speed, Harry pocketed it. I just put that extra syllable in. Weird.
Everyone's... Stephen Fry, Heroes is the latest. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
A tongue twister indeed. Now, a forgotten chapter of American history now, the city of Wilmington, North Carolina, once stood out as a vibrant mixed-race community. But that all came to a dramatic end in 1898 when white supremacists staged a bloody coup. Yes, a coup in America. The city's government was overthrown and 60 black men were killed. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Zucchino is putting it all down on paper in his new book, Wilmington's Lie. And he sat down with our Walter Isaacson to talk about how the uprising started and about its long-lasting impact.
This is an amazing book because it's about 1898, but it's also about today. Describe what it was like in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898.
Well, before the coup, Wilmington was really an outlier. It was unusual. It was unique among southern cities. And first of all, it had a majority black population. It was 56% black. I think New Orleans was something like 27%. Louisville was 17%. But more importantly, it had a multiracial government, which was very unusual at the time. You had black men in positions of power. You had 3 of the 10 city aldermen were black. 10 of the 26 policemen were black. You had black magistrates. The superintendent of streets was black. The county treasurer was black. So there was this real sort of meeting of the white Republicans and black Republicans sharing power in a mid-sized southern town, biggest city in North Carolina at the time, an important commercial port. And this just drove the white supremacists crazy, and they were not going to stand with it. And they put in place a plan that lasted for several months leading up to the midterm elections in 1898.
But even of other places around the South, in the early 1890s, you have a lot of blacks who've registered to vote. Mm-hmm. They start getting electoral power. So Wilmington is a... sort of a big example of it.
Exactly.
But throughout that period, we hadn't yet had this backlash, right?
Exactly right. And there were other towns that did have black officials, but I think Wilmington was unique. There was a Baptist publication in 1898 that called it, quote, the freest town for a Negro in the country. The other thing that was unusual about Wilmington was that residentially, it was very mixed. There was still segregation in some neighborhoods, but there were a lot of neighborhoods where whites and blacks lived next to each other, particularly the working class. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting. But as you say, this was going on throughout the South. But at the same time, white supremacists, ever since the end of Reconstruction in 1877, had been working very hard to tamp down the black vote, to crush the black vote, to terrorize blacks. And as you know, they called themselves the Redeemer, and they were redeeming the South for white supremacy.
Why did that happen in the 1890s?
In the 1890s, there was a terrible recession, and poor white farmers who belonged to the Populist Party became dissatisfied with the Democratic Party, which, as you know, and our listeners know, was the party of white supremacy at that time. And they abandoned the Democratic Party and went over to the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln and the party of black suffrage. And they combined in something called fusion. And by 1894, with the blacks working together with white Republicans and black Republicans, took over the state legislature. And the next year, they took over the city government in Wilmington. And this was truly unusual in the South. And again, as I say, the white supremacists weren't going to stand for that. They vowed to win the election in 1898 by the ballot or the bullet or both, and they announced it beforehand.
And it's such a dramatic tale. How did it begin in Wilmington?
It began in the spring of 1898. A man named Josephus Daniels, the founding publisher of the News and Observer, which was the paper in Raleigh, the capital, by far the most important and influential paper in the state, met with the head of the Democratic Party, a man named Fernfold Simmons. And they said, quote, "Negro rule is going to destroy us. Our biggest threat is the black voter, particularly in eastern North Carolina and southeastern North Carolina." There were 18 counties that had black majorities, including the county for Wilmington. They called it the Black Belt. And this was an existential threat to white supremacy. And so they came up with a plan, and they called it the White Supremacy Campaign. They actually titled it that. And their plan was to convince white voters that, first of all, blacks were incompetent, incapable of voting, and the blacks in government were totally corrupt. The government was totally corrupt. And at the same time, they presented blacks as sexually insatiable. They were coming after the white women of the South. They were going to rape your women, and they're going to take your jobs. So they started this campaign through the spring and the summer and the fall, leading up to the midterm elections in the fall, to convince white voters, particularly the populace, that, quote, "Negro rule, Negro domination would lead to amalgamation and race mixing. The white race would be destroyed. Our power would be gone. The blacks will take over."
But it wasn't just a propaganda campaign against blacks. They decided to make it an armed militia against blacks.
Right. They, in addition to having this fake news campaign and this propaganda campaign, they had their own militia. They were called Red Shirts. And in effect, it was the Klan. You had an extremely well-armed white populace. At the same time, they refused to sell weapons or ammunition to blacks. So there was no way for the blacks to defend themselves. And in addition, they had this red shirt militia, and their job was to ride out through the Cape Fear countryside at night, barge into blacks' homes, pull the men out, whip them, beat them, intimidate them, and say, "If you dare to register to vote, we're going to come back and kill you."
So how many blacks were registered to vote?
In 1896, in the whole state, there were 126,000. By 1902, just 6 years later, there were 6,000. So you can see how effective this was. And now on Election Day in November of 1898, some blacks they're very courageous. They worked up the courage and they tried to get to the polls. The red shirts were out there intimidating them, stopping them, beating them, but a lot of them got through and they did manage to vote. But only a small percentage of the actual registered voters were able to vote on that day. And at the same time, the red shirts barged into polling places and stuffed phony Democratic ballots and destroyed the Republican ballots. And you ended up with situations in precincts where the candidate won by more votes than the total number of registered people in the district. So they won the election by fraud and by intimidation.
But they also were very well armed, and they were planning to, and did, use violence.
Absolutely. In addition to the private militia, they had two state militias. There was the Wilmington Light Infantry and the City Naval Reserves, and these were basically the National Guard of the day. They were supposed to report to the Republican governor in Raleigh, but in fact, they reported to the leaders of the white supremacy movement. The colonel was a member of one of the secret committees of white supremacists who were planning the insurrection. every member of both these militias were white supremacists.
You have a brutal passage in your book about that colonel.
Mm-hmm.
The night before the coup or the war.
Right.
And what he said. Do you mind reading it?
Yeah, I would love to. And this is Colonel Alfred Moore Waddell. He was a former Confederate officer. He was a former congressman. And he was the man who led the red shirts, who would lead them the next day on the riot. And this was the night before the election. And this was a speech that he gave to the red shirts. Quote, "Men, the crisis is upon us. You must do your duty. This city, county, and state shall be rid of Negro domination once and forever. You have the courage. You are brave. You are the sons of noble ancestry. You are Anglo-Saxons. You are armed and prepared, and you will do your duty. Go to the polls tomorrow, and if you find the Negro out voting, tell him to leave the polls. And if he refuses, kill him. Shoot him down in his tracks."
Shoot him down in his tracks. So from the beginning, this was not just intimidation. This was actual murder being planned.
This was a planned murder spree. A state commission in 2006 had spent 5 years looking into this, and they estimated that at least 60 black men were killed that day, and dozens more were wounded. Hundreds of these families fled. They're terrified, and they went into the woods, into a black cemetery, thinking the white gunmen wouldn't go there. They went into the swamps, and they hid for 2 nights and 3 days, and it was November. And it was cold, and it happened to be raining that first night, and there were reports that some babies died of exposure. And they were so terrified, it took them 3 days for Colonel Waddell. The irony of this is after the coup, after the violence, he starts issuing proclamations saying, "Wow, well, we've got to get control of the situation. We don't want any armed gunmen out on the streets. We want law and order now." And so he had to convince. He sent emissaries out to convince these black families, it's fine, it's safe, you can come back. But of course, as soon as they came back, families just started fleeing Wilmington. 2,100 in the weeks and in the months after the coup fled the city and never came back. The city was 56% black, as I had said, in 1898. Today, it's 18%. So they just turned a black majority city overnight into this white supremacist citadel.
President McKinley,
yes.
He knew about this.
Absolutely, had been warned about it. There was a man named George Henry White, who was a congressman, a black man from North Carolina, was the only congressman, the only black congressman in the entire country. He was from southeastern North Carolina in a district right next to Wilmington. He went to the White House and met with McKinley and warned him because, as I said, they announced ahead of time they were going to do this. Everyone knew about it. It was covered by all the major papers of the day. Congressman White went to McKinley and warned him. Also, a delegation of black ministers went and warned him. After the insurrection, the coup, whatever you want to call it, George Henry White went back to the White House, talked to McKinley again. The black ministers went and talked to him again. I could find no record that McKinley ever uttered one word in public about the massacre.
Among the heroes in your book is a mixed race man who, I guess, was trying to keep this from happening.
Mm-hmm. He was my favorite character in the book. And as a journalist, I just fell in love with his name was Alex Manley. Mm-hmm. And he was actually the grandson of a white North Carolina governor and the son of a slave. He started a daily newspaper called the Daily Record in Wilmington, and he was an advocate for civil rights. He demanded that the country live up to its promises to its black citizens. He wrote exposés. He got improvements in road conditions in black neighborhoods, sanitary conditions in black neighborhoods. He wrote an exposé on the so-called colored ward at the city hospital and got grudging improvements from the whites who ran it. In August of 1898, he responded to a speech by a woman named Mrs. Felton in Georgia, who was the wife of a prominent politician. She gave a stirring speech in Georgia about lynching and about alleged rapes of white women by black men. And in the speech, she said the solution to these rapes is the lynch rope. I say lynch 1,000 times a week if necessary. Alex Manley read this the very next day. He wrote a response. And in his editorial, it was an incredibly brave thing for a black man to do at that time with the white supremacy movement in full swing. He wrote that supposed rapes by black men of white women were in many cases, the men were actually the consensual lovers of the white women, and that black men were attractive to white women, and whites were hypocrites because white men would rape black women with impunity. It happened all the time in Wilmington and elsewhere, and he had the courage to point this out. As you can imagine, this did not go over well, and in fact, this was reprinted across the South, and people were enraged. The Red Shirts, the next day, wanted to lynch Alex Manley, and to show you how calculated this whole plot was, they were ordered by the leaders of the white supremacy movement, say, no, wait, we'll have greater political impact if we wait till the election in November, and then you can lynch Alex Manley. That'll be fine. But for now, we're going to let this simmer and let it stir, and we'll make use of it in November. And he was warned about the lynch. Well, he knew that the lynch party was coming from him, and he got out of town just in time. He fled and never went back.
It almost raises a notion of a counter history, which is, what if this type of thing hadn't have happened and we hadn't had this 1890s white supremacist backlash? You know, would the whole history of this nation be different?
Possibly. I mean, you have to wonder if that never happened. Would Wilmington have gone on and been this black mecca? Would you have had these 18 counties electing black people to Congress? In 1900, George Henry White, the congressman, was just hounded out of the state. He refused to run for re-election. He knew it was too dangerous. His parting words to the New York Times were, "I cannot live in North Carolina and be treated like a man." He left and never came back. And from that day on, there no black citizens served in Congress until 1992, almost 100 years later.
The Wilmington Massacre isn't really known to history that well because it gets written up in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s with a whole different angle to it.
Absolutely. I mean, the cliche is that the victors write history, and they wrote the history. They were proud of what they had done. They boasted about it in letters and diaries and newspaper articles, but they portrayed it as a victory for good, clean government by white men over this corrupt and incompetent, quote, black rule. And they also, all that summer and fall, had been planning newspaper stories that it wasn't the whites who were stockpiling weapons, it was the blacks. And then on election day, the blacks were going to rise up with their weapons and take over the town and start a riot. So the history they wrote was, we unfortunately had to kill a few black people because they were armed and had tried to start a riot. And that's the way the story was written for more than 100 years. And that's one reason I wanted to write this book, is to correct the historical record. This story is known, obviously, in North Carolina, but not that many people. I run into people all over North Carolina who said, I've never heard of this. Mm-hmm. When I go around the country, I can't find anybody who's ever heard of this.
The writing of this history begins to change, though, as the centennial approaches in 1998, right?
Right. In 1998, the University of North Carolina at Wilmington said, listen, this history has been covered up. It's been mischaracterized. Let's bring the blacks and the whites together, including some of the descendants of the people involved, and let's try to have some racial healing. Let's address this thing and let's tell the story. So I think there was some racial healing, but it was very painful. There were a lot of whites at the time who said, why are we dredging this up? This is ancient history. You're stirring up racial trouble. This is over. Let's just move on. At the same time, as you can imagine, the blacks felt this very deeply. This was 100 years later, but their families had been destroyed. Their lives had been destroyed. Their families were scattered across the country. The black middle class was destroyed. They felt this very deeply, and there were demands for reparations. And then there was a blowback from the whites who said, no, we'll never pay reparations. So it became a very emotional time, but I think in the end they did reach some reconciliation.
David Zucchino, thank you for being with
us. Thank you. Great to be with you, Walter.
The historical perspective is always important. Finally, many of us are anxious about the coronavirus, but ultimately information will be how we overcome it. The digital age contrasts sharply to 1918, when 50 million people were killed by the Spanish flu. And in the classic novel Pale Horse, Pale Rider, about that pandemic, the character Miranda, a journalist, is asked to close her eyes. She replies, "No, for then I see worse things." So if there's anything that we've learned this turbulent week and we want to pass on, it is this. Keep your eyes open like Miranda. Listen to the science, to the experts and the evidence. Take sensible precautions because facts are much less frightening than rumors and ignorance. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast and across social media. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.